Hello and welcome to the fourth edition of the Stuff We Like podcast. I'm David Simmons, and for the next half hour or so we will be talking about stuff we like. And in this, our illustrious fourth episode, we're going to be talking about the arts. It's quite a general approach, so anything goes, from the fine arts to literature to films to music, you name it. Sadly, we don't have copyright on stuff, so we can't play excerpts or pieces of music or even read from the books. But that won't necessarily stop us enthusing anyway about all things arty in this podcast. So kick off your shoes, tip back your favourite chair, make up your favourite drink, and tune in for the next little while as we bring you the arts in Stuff We Like. I thought I'd start with literature. It's such a wide-ranging field, but given that this podcast is the youngest sibling of the Stuff We Like WordPress blog, I may as well talk about something that I've mentioned in the blog. To paraphrase myself, apparently, I've learned you can plagiarise yourself too, but that's another topic. Whenever a murder needs to be solved, look no further than an unassuming hunchback lawyer called Matthew Shardlake. Okay, granted, the murder has to have been committed in the late 1530s and 1540s, during the time of the reign of King Henry VIII, and the victims are usually part of the upper echelons of Tudor society, and they usually involve intrigue, murder, mystery and dark villainy. Shardlake is a wonderful literary creation. He's a jobbing lawyer working in the Inns of Holborn, rubbing shoulders with the likes of Sir Richard Rich and, of course, the great Thomas Cromwell. And because the cases he has to solve end up threatening the very existence of the English crown, he frequently has to go undercover and is often betrayed and misunderstood, and like some of the great 20th century detectives also, somehow never manages to have his romantic longings requited. The novels also give an in-depth portrayal of life in the mid-16th century in all its grim and opulent wonder, and the writer, C.J. Sansom, manages to create an atmosphere which permeates the story and get under the skin of the characters and also of us, the readers. Some familiar characters keep returning. Some return only to be summarily dispatched by either Sansom himself or by history or both. And the books contain a fair reflection of English history as well as being very well-paced thrillers. The novels begin with an unsolved murder during the dissolution of the monasteries, and lead through the lives of King Henry and his trusted adviser Thomas Cromwell, as well as the marriages later of Catherine Howard and Catherine Parr. Shardlake is a faithful narrator, taking us through events which we as readers have the ability to view with hindsight. So if you haven't sampled the delights of C.J. Sansom's books already, have a look at the Shardlake series. Dissolution, Dark Fire, Sovereign, Revelation, and Heartstone. Okay, interview with James Ratnaraja, filmmaker and graphic designer.
Yes.
Tell me about yourself.
Well, pretty much summed it up. Filmmaker and a graphic designer. So I've been a graphic designer for about 7 years now. Mm-hmm. And for as long as I've been a designer, I've wanted to be a filmmaker. But at a certain point in my life, it was like flip a coin and pursue a certain career. So I pursued design, but I've always had that attraction to film, which has been pulling me in. And thankfully, in recent years, I've been able to pursue that again and kick that up as something to...
Do you find the design helps you to pay for the film?
Yes, definitely.
Good.
Definitely. So my job as a designer allows me to support myself, which is the priority. And then, yeah, be able to fund myself. I mean, I just finished a degree at Central St Martins, which my final project was film. Mm-hmm. And thankfully I was able to pay my whole way through the course, but also to fund quite a decent film with good production values. We didn't scrimp that much. And yeah, so the job was able to pay for all of that, which is nice.
Fantastic. Okay. Right, well, without any further ado, your top five films.
Yes. So, yeah, this was very, very difficult for me. I mean, I was exclaiming on Twitter how difficult this was to do. And I think it's temporal because obviously you're always coming across amazing new films.
Mm.
One of those...
Absolutely.
I just saw Hugo, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an amazing film, but that's not in my list because there are other things that come above that. But yeah, it's this thing of obviously these kind of things are temporal. But I think the what I set myself the rule of was what films have impacted me the most filmmaker and as a designer. And I think that kind of made it easier to think about those films. So yeah, the first one for me, which I'm going to count as one, even though I know it is three films, is the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Cool.
And I think for me, Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship came out when I was about 16. So mm-hmm. I think it was very, very key in making me want to pursue filmmaking. I think it opened up the world of possibilities of what filmmaking could be. Because when the DVDs came out, you watched all the special features and you saw how Peter Jackson had approached this film in a very independent filmmaking way with a huge budget behind him. So one day they were filming on these massive landscapes in New Zealand, and then next they were doing a scene in his living room.
Yeah.
And then that was just...
They filmed one of the external sequences in a parking lot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. And just added green screen and effects and all the rest, yeah.
And that very fact of seeing how he made the film...
Yeah.
And then, well, actually seeing the thing on screen was just amazing. It was the... It wasn't just this thing of big budget, let's throw in as many fight scenes and visual effects as possible, but it was also... had an amazingly intimate heart to it, which they managed to carry through throughout all three films. And I think seeing those things just made you realise what is actually possible. And
it's epic, but it tells a story through the characters, through the heart of the characters. Okay.
Exactly. So I think in terms of taking it back to my filmmaking, it is this thing of it was foundational in making me want to become a filmmaker. Brilliant. And I think that's why it's such an amazing film for me. So that's very selfish.
So three in one. We'll let you have that.
The second one is Neil Burger's The Illusionist.
Okay.
Which is Ed Norton, Jessica Biel, and Rufus Sewell, and Paul Giamatti.
Mm-hmm.
That film appeals to my love of illusion and magic, which feeds into this... I have an amazing passion for fantasy, and I obviously think magic and illusion is part and parcel of fantasy. And what The Illusionist does is show a very, very, very simple story without any frills. It's very pulled back. It's stripped away to the heart of an amazing story, which most viewers who've seen it will see the end coming. There is a twist to the end, but if you've got half a brain, I think you'd be able to see the twist coming. But that's not what matters. It's about how Neil Burger uses this idea of magic and illusion, which is, in the time that it was set in the early 20th century, it was just seen as a very scary thing. But what actually all the illusionists at the time were doing was just showing, they wanted to use that sense of wonder to open up truth and open up stuff in the real world. And The Illusionist is about revealing political corruption at its highest form,
okay,
using magic and illusion. And I think that was just really interesting to me. And that's what I just love the film, because as I said before, it's stripped back. There's nothing other than the story with a few visual effects thrown in because they have to for the illusion. So, but yeah, it was just an amazing film that opened up this thing of magic and illusion in a historical context, which is really interesting.
Brilliant. Wow. It's also a film by Sylvain Chomet, isn't it? There's an animated cartoon called The Illusionist.
There is.
Which
has led to some very confusing conversations when I talk about The Illusionist and then people have got that film in their
heads. Yes, in their heads, yeah.
And then, it leads to very interesting conversations.
Okay, next.
Yeah, so the next one for me, which I'm shocked to discover, wasn't actually that well received, is Bicentennial Man.
Okay.
With Robin Williams. I was very shocked when I was thinking about the films, and I thought, okay, let's look at Rotten Tomatoes. And Rotten Tomatoes give it 35%, which is the lowest percentage I've seen in a film for ages. But I absolutely adore that film. It's obviously based on Asimov's stories.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think Bicentennial Man achieved for me was... It was a family film, but it exposed this very interesting concept of immortality and what the quality of life and death.
Okay.
And so, for those of you who haven't seen it, without giving too much away, it's about a robot that gets delivered to a family's house, and he's there to serve.
Mm.
But as the story progresses, you see that this robot starts to develop emotion and starts to develop a connection with the family. And then it's about his life over 200 years that he lives and how he, towards the end of the film, wants to be recognised as human, because he believes he is human because of his emotions and the love that he has. He falls in love with someone, a human.
Gosh.
And it sounds crazy. And when I was told about the film, I was like, I can't come off it, a robot falling in love, that's really stupid. But what the film does really well is gets to you. It gets to your heart very quickly. And then you forget that this main character, the person that you're rooting for, is actually a machine.
Mm.
And it makes us think, yeah, it just makes us think about what it means to be human.
It's an interesting trope that recurs in films, doesn't it? You've got Blade Runner, the whole thing about what is a replicant, what is human. You've got AI, of course, which Spielberg and Kubrick famously investigated in their film. So it's one of those things that does recur. In fact, there's a new one just come out, and the title I forget, but that also deals with the same thing. A guy gets a servant who happens to be a robot, and it does explore the whole thing of what is human. He has a more real friendship with the robot than he does with the people around him. So it's a fascinating, endless thing you could explore. Of course, the whole thing about eternity and what it is to live forever, and the pluses and minuses of that, you explored in your own films.
Yes.
Mm.
So for my final project for uni, I developed a film called The Eternal Man, which was about this very thing, about if someone is afraid of dying, his solution to that is to live forever, and he develops something whereby he can live forever, and then he has to deal with the consequences.
Yeah, because his loved ones... Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I think, Bicentennial Man, it could be argued that a lot of people see it as a film that argues the case for artificial intelligence and why it was going to be a bad thing. I don't think that's the point of Bicentennial Man. I think Bicentennial Man is to show us, the audience, what it actually means to be human, and using this very surreal concept of a robot that lives forever and then decides that he can love.
Mm.
It's just a vehicle for us to look at our own lives and say, okay, what is it about us that makes us human? So that's why I think it's a very interesting film.
Okay, next.
The next one is Atonement with Keira Knightley and James McAvoy.
Mm-hmm.
I love Joe Wright's work. Mm. I really love his work. And when you look at his CV, it's not many films, but the films that he has done are fantastic. And what I find really interesting about Atonement is that I love war films. I think I grew up on them through my dad just watching them all the time. But I think what Atonement does, it uses the war not as the main focus but as a backdrop for a very heartbreaking story.
Mm.
So from that point of view, it appeals to my senses of using traditional things that film discusses, in this case war, but taking it from a completely different approach and how actually the war separated these two people that loved each other.
Right.
So, again, it's using popular things, but taking it from a slightly different angle.
From a technical viewpoint, what I love about Joe Wright's work is within each of his films, he puts in a long tracking shot.
Which was amazing. I mean, the Dunkirk sequence was incredible. Fantastic.
And you just think, how often can you set that up?
Exactly.
Every time. Five times we're going to do this. It's just bonkers. And he does it in Pride and Prejudice as well. There's a scene in the party where the camera just tracks through all these rooms and you get the character, the very strange vicar, keeps popping up in various rooms. It's hilarious.
Yeah. And which is interesting is because Joe Wright's currently directing a theatre production.
Yes, he is, yeah.
So I think he's taking...
He grew up in a puppet theatre, didn't he?
Oh,
his parents ran a puppet theatre,
So
in London.
So taking the theatrical element and putting it into film, so the tracking shots of, okay, the audience are going to stay focused on one thing for a very long time, it's just amazing. And what I like about Atonement from the story point of view, I know this is going to sound really macabre probably, but I like films that give so many obstacles for the character to overcome. Face that it strips them back and back and nearly destroys them.
Right.
I know that sounds horrible, but it's this thing of, that's what life is sometimes. Life is a series of challenges that we face, and sometimes we don't overcome them, or we're not the better for them. Sometimes they do strip something of us away and then reveal what is actually there what is
the real person, real about underneath. Us.
And I think,
which is a robot, I presume.
But what Joe Wright does is handle that process of a man who's got everything going for him.
James McAvoy's character, yeah.
Exactly, which then gets many things stripped away from him through a really big misunderstanding.
Yes.
But you still see the kind of person that he is after all of that. And I think Joe Wright handles that with great dignity and sensitivity. It's so easy. I think it's would be so easy to just throw all this rubbish at the character and then do it in a very insensitive way. But Joe Wright just handles it beautifully. And I think the performances throughout that film with Saoirse Ronan as well.
She's incredible. Trivia moment. Benedict Cumberbatch, of course, plays the villain. Yeah. And Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss saw him in Atonement and thought he would make a perfect Sherlock Holmes.
Wow, I didn't know that's how he got the job.
Mark Gatiss tweeted it only recently, so there you go.
Wow.
You heard it here first. Okay, and finally?
The final film is V for Vendetta.
Mm-hmm.
I love graphic novels, and Alan Moore's work is fantastic. I'm not sure how he views the film adaptation of his work. I'm not sure if he agreed with it or authorised it, but what I think that film... The main thing I love about that film is that the protagonist is an anti-hero. He's someone that we shouldn't really be rooting
right.
for. And yep. I think, again, that's very interesting in film, that not necessarily the main character that we follow has to be necessarily the good guy.
Yeah.
And what does that do for the audience? And what does that... For me, watching V for Vendetta, it showed this man that had horrible things done to him, and you see why he does what he does, but then you don't agree with it, and then that again helps you build your view of what life should be about. It could be argued that he's fighting a very dictatorial machine, but the manner in which he does that is awful. He just murders and he does horrible things, but we still root for him. And I think, what does that say about us and our society? Does the end justify the means? V's character does things that would be considered the work of a terrorist.
Yeah.
And the audience root for him. So what does that say about us? And I think that brings out some very interesting things, especially in light of what's happening recently, you know, like with the Occupy campaigns like America and Britain and things like that. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Yes.
So it's, again, V for Vendetta pulls out these kind of elements of what is terrorism, what does it mean to fight for freedom, who is the bad guy, who are the good guys. And it makes the audience root for someone and then think to themselves, should I be rooting?
Yeah.
This guy's doing some awful things.
You flip your sort of morals on their head, don't you?
Yeah. And the film has an amazing power to do that.
Yes, yes.
And I think for great effect at times, and V for Vendetta is one of those occasions where I think it's a film that does that to you. It flips your morals. But then when you walk away from the film, you're like, why? What do I think about government? What do I think about politics? And does the power belong to the people? Does the power belong in the hands of a few? And I think, V for Vendetta is a very good film that raises those questions.
Excellent. Okay, if we want to know more about you, how can we find out?
So you can follow me on Twitter.
Right.
So it's twitter.com/JamesRatnaraja, spell Ratnaraja, RatnaraJah. Or you can visit my website, jamesratnaraja.com. We've got a couple of film projects coming up this year. So going to be updating Twitter and my blog on my website.
Fantastic.
For news about that.
James Ratnaraja, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Okay, if I were to ask you the question, when was the last time you went to see a show at the National Theatre? You might say, a few months ago or last week. But for many people, the National Theatre appears to be an institution which kind of sits on the south bank of London, producing endless plays and other things in repertory, and is doing quite well all by itself, troubling only its regular audiences, thank you very much. People may not think it impinges on their lives in the provinces or anywhere else. I think the last time I went to browse its wonderful bookshop was possibly last year sometime, or maybe to listen to a Promenade concert. I can't remember. I think I went to see the Trestle Theatre at the Littleton maybe 10 years ago. But under the auspices of artistic director Nicholas Heitner, something of a revolution has been taking place at the Old Nash. It's not necessary any longer just to visit the South Bank to feel the irrepressible pull of the company. Play's been extending now into the West End with something approaching dependable regularity, with History Boys selling out in the West End and Broadway and later being turned into a film and launching the careers of Russell Tovey, Dominic Cooper, James Corden, to name but three of the cast. I was then privileged to see the cast of One Man, Two Governors with James Corden in the lead after it had transferred to the West End, and it was superb. It was a truly wonderful night out. And again, it garnered awards on Broadway as well. Danny Boyle's Frankenstein, starring the ubiquitous Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Lee Miller, who alternated the lead roles, didn't transfer to the West End, but it was live filmed, and the audience was extended that way. And live filming of plays is another pioneering theatrical development which the National has played a key part. And the hits just keep coming. Untold Stories, Recollections by Alan Bennett, starring Alex Jennings as the playwright, just transferred to the West End to great reviews. And of course, anyone who has seen Steven Spielberg's film of War Horse will be aware that the illustrious director was moved to adapt the book for the screen when he went to see the National Theatre production of the same name and was moved to tears. And that, of course, has also transferred successfully to the West End and is on my list of things to do this year. Forthcoming productions include yet another West End transfer of the hugely successful adaptation of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, and the company's also experimenting with new theatre spaces and developing its audience through its touring productions. And if that's not enough, Adrian Lester is about to begin his run as Othello with Rory Kinnear as Iago sometime in April, I think. And that, of course, will be directed by Nicholas Heitner, who's possibly the most successful artistic director commercially that the National Theatre has ever had. So remember, the National Theatre is not just a series of spaces on the South Bank of London, but is rapidly becoming a commercial cornerstone of British theatre, not just receiving grant funding, but actually creating its own wealth and its own opportunities in a truly remarkable way. Ever at the forefront of technology, if you check out ntlive.nationaltheatre.org.uk, the website will take you to the National Theatre Live, where you can actually watch productions across the UK from special selected venues. It's definitely worth a visit. Thanks once again to filmmaker James Ratnaraja for his top five films, even if one of them was actually three films. Out of the whole of The Lord of the Rings, it's hard to pick a favourite of my own. I've eventually opted for the extended Return of the King DVD, as it has so much in it, as well as about four or five endings. But to be fair to Peter Jackson, so does the book. I will let you know another of my own top five during the next Stuff We Like Arts podcast. Chris McLeod would like to enthuse about any film with James Stewart, always a dependable screen presence, which makes me ask the question, who would your modern-day James Stewart equivalent be? Does such an actor exist? Let me know. In other news, word on the ground is that the Liechtenstein retrospective at the Tate Modern Gallery on the South Bank of London is absolutely fantastic, and that exhibition is on until the 27th of May 2013. And that makes me ask my next question. We heard James Ratnaraja's top five films, but what would be your top five films? Your top five books? Your top five paintings? Your top five gigs? Your top five plays? Let us know either through Twitter, email, using the contact details at the end of the podcast. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Stuff We Like. Remember, if you want to contact me, you can either get through to me on Twitter at David Simmons, or alternatively, try emailing dhsimmons@outlook.com and mark your email Stuff We Like.